Today's operation is the frustration of Vietnam in miniature.
I shall not see.
The worst area we've been in since I've been in Vietnam. Awful sick, and I'll be so glad to go home.
And I will not accept.
As men clamored over one another, pushing aside women and children in their panic-stricken fury, members of the air crew dragged them onto the plane, trying to fill it as fast as possible.
The nomination of my party for another term as your president.
For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate.
This is Dr. Stephen Nurse. These episodes of Is Abled focus on the brave men and women who fought in the Vietnam War, not the politics that surrounded the war. This is The War in Vietnam, Part 2. Those who were there are still fighting because the jungle changes a man. Hello, again, this is Steve Nurse, and this is our second series on Vietnam. And again, our purpose in doing this was not to get in so much the politics of the war, but to deal with the individuality of the war and how it affected people. I have friends that it affected very, very positively and friends that it affected very negatively. Also, there are those that have suffered from Agent Orange and are still suffering from Agent Orange. I'd also like to give a special shout out to a family of mine, family friends of mine, the Bolays. Carrie Bolay is the wife, and Lee Bolay is the father, who just passed away from Parkinson's, and he was a veteran too. So this is really a series for all veterans. He was in the Navy about the same time and received the highest honor that you can in the Navy for living veterans. And he was on a boat that they were doing maneuvers in the Philippines, and one boat hit the other boat, and they were very large boats. And so it opened up the side of the ship. The ship sunk, and he saved a person from drowning that essentially fell out of his bunk into the water. So, again, thanks to Lee for his service and for his family. Today, we are going to be interviewing Robert DeGrappa, and Robert now lives on the island. He saw the article in the Beachcomber, I think, and my writing was confusing enough that he called me and said he'd like to be included, and that's exactly what we're looking for. So, Robert, tell me about going into the service when you were young and didn't have gray hair like me and all of us now.
Yeah, I went in 1967 when I was 17. My mother and her husband signed papers for me. It was kind of one of those things like, well, it's better to go in the military than end up in jail. So that's what I did, and I ended up being assigned to a special op unit in Europe, in Germany, that was attached to NATO. We were a long-range reconnaissance patrol, and one of the forerunners of the Delta Force, everybody in my company was an expert, which is interesting because out of 100 guys, 38 of us were high school dropouts, but mm-hmm. we were all experts in our fields, you know, even right. at 17. And we all had secret clearances because we studied Russian aircraft and we fired a lot of weapons and went on NATO operations. So it was interesting at 17 and parachuting out of planes and choppers, and it was quite heady.
At that time, did you think that you were kind of invulnerable to, I mean, at 17, we don't really have a full grasp of life. I mean, did you... So it was just kind of an exciting thing for you at that point.
Oh, absolutely. When the Russian tanks rolled into Prague in 1968, my company, since we were a special op unit, we were on call to parachute into Czechoslovakia. And I was 17, and I'm like, no, you can't send me. You know, but we were in our rooms, full battle gear, waiting to get on the plane when the orders finally came in to say no.
And when did you go to Vietnam?
Well, they sent my unit back to Benning, and where we continued to jump more. We trained with Marine Recon, and I trained with the Germans and the British in counterinsurgency. And then this is the only time that's ever happened in the military. My whole company received orders to go to Ranger School. But I'd been training for 14 months. We didn't even have to apply. They just said, you're going, the whole outfit. So I went to the old man and I said, sir, I've been training for 14 months. I know we're all going to Nam after this, so can you just give me my orders now? Let's get this over with. So he did, which I regret not going to Ranger School, although in one operation with the Rangers, we lost 10 guys and just they got hit in an L-shaped ambush, which you'd think that a Ranger team wouldn't walk into something like that, but they lost a lot of guys too, the Rangers.
Mm-hmm. One of the questions I've asked everybody is, what was your first perception when you landed in Vietnam? What do you remember from landing there?
Well, obviously, when we walk outside the plane, I'm sure Donald agree with this, was the heat and the humidity. You couldn't even hardly breathe. And then they put you on a bus, and you know they took us into, this was on K. And I remember, you know, seeing the Vietnamese walking down both sides of the road, and of course a dirt road. And you know, when they had to do something, like the ladies, they would just squat right there and pull their pants aside, you know, their leg, and do it right there alongside the road. And I thought, we're definitely in a different world here.
Yeah.
But when I was going into the barracks, and we passed a chopper that was on, you know, on the ground, and it had a full, you know, ammo, the 60s, the belt was hanging on the 60s, and the rockets were all in the pods, and I thought, this is the real deal now. This ain't no training operation.
Yeah.
That's what really struck me.
The reason that I asked that question about when you landed, I think, you know, Rick and I have done quite a few of these interviews. And I think that's the response that we've gotten from just about everybody. That we've gotten comments like, "You could bite the air." You know, it seemed like it was so thick. And I also think the other part of that is that kind of that you said, "What am I getting into?" You know. All of a sudden, something is becoming a reality. So then where did you go from that point? You went out and...
Well, the new guys have to go to jungle school. You go to jungle school for a couple of weeks, and you know they teach you about booby traps and things like that. And then you have to burn the refuse from the outhouses.
Right.
With the diesel fuel and stuff, it was miserable. All the new guys had to do that. And then they sent me to my unit, which was A Company, 3rd Bat, 503rd Infantry, 173rd Airborne Brigade. And we were in Balak, which was alongside Monkey Mountain, which was the mountain that separated Cambodia from Vietnam. And we were on the other side, and that was our base camp.
I think I got some pictures of Monkey Mountain and some of the vets that have sent me stuff, but that seemed to be kind of one of the main places that people were doing a lot of activity. So on a, you know, so what was your average day in Vietnam? What did you, you know, when you, after you got out there and got through the Ranger School and all that stuff, what...
Well, I didn't go to Ranger School.
I'm sorry. After you went to jungle school.
Yeah, Jungle School. And then...
And that's not just Jungle Gym.
Well, my MOS was 05 Bravo, which is a radio operator. But having been in the long-range recon patrol, you have a secondary of 11 Bravo, or 11 Bush, as we used to call it, of infantry. So my expertise was with Morse code. I could send and receive Morse code almost as, I wouldn't say as fast as you can talk, but I was pretty good at it. So when I got to my base camp, I didn't have to go out to the bush. I could have stayed as a radio operator in the base camp. But when I saw the guys coming in off of an operation, and the 173rd did not wear conventional gear, at least my battalion didn't. These guys had AK bandoliers and Vietnamese boonie hats and tiger fatigues and NVA rucksacks. And I mean, I thought, this is for me. I'm not going to hang out here, you know. So I told the old man, I said, I want to go to the bush. And he said, what? He said, okay. You know, so the next chopper, I was on my way to my outfit, which was, I'll never forget, we're triple canopy jungle. You can't see the ground. You can just see treetops. And it was me and one other guy. And I said to the crew chief, I said, man, where are we going? Because you couldn't see the ground. And he said, you'll see. So we finally, after about a half hour, we get, you can see this little opening in the trees. And we were probably at 10,000 feet, 15,000 feet flying. And he goes, you see that little opening down there? That's where you're going. And that's where we went.
Wow.
And we hadn't been off the chopper 5 minutes when we were getting probed by the VC, and they opened up on the OPs opened up on the...
And OP is?
Observation point, you know.
Okay.
Observation post.
So these guys were looking for you when you came down.
Yeah.
And like you said, it's pretty hard to hide the sound of a Huey coming in.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And it was so funny because I had just gotten, the platoon leader gave me my food, my sea rats, some of them, and told me what squad. So I'm walking over in this heavy jungle to the squad, and then the rounds started flying. And all my food I threw up in the air, and I hit the deck, and the old timers are going, don't shoot, Cherry, don't shoot, because you couldn't see anything, you know. And I didn't have to worry about not shooting because I didn't know what to shoot at.
Yeah.
They were afraid I'd shoot them, you know.
Right.
I was pretty disciplined when it came to shooting, though.
Uh-huh. Well, that's good. And, I think I think people our age, I think, have a different respect for even firearms. I mean, when I was a kid, I, you know, like I said, I grew up in Ellensburg and I hunted and fished and did all that stuff. But before you got a shotgun or a 22 or 22 Mossberg 8-shot clip that I had, not very lethal, but, you know, you took basic safety training. You know, you learned how to go over a fence. You learned how to do those things. And, that could be a problem now. When you were out in the field, were you out in the field for days at a time, or were you dropped in the morning and picked up in the afternoon? Or
we went out
for cocktails, whatever.
Yeah, you know, right. We'd go for 2 or 3 weeks in the bush, mm-hmm. and we'd get resupplied every 3 days, or depending, it could have been 5 days too. So if we were out for 3 weeks, they might resupply us every 5 days. If we were out for 2 weeks, you know, it'd be like maybe every 3 days. Mm-hmm. But we lived out in the bush that whole time, and then, you know, we'd come back in for a week and go back out. That's what we did.
So when you were out there with a group of other soldiers, What were your main concerns? What were you most worried about? I mean, there's got to be a lot of kind of ominous feeling at the same time. It's always amazing when I see pictures of these guys that are in landing zones and that are out in the bush. You know, And obviously, they're probably doing some R&R, but they're smiling. I mean, it's not like everybody's, they're looking sad on their face all the time when they're in a pretty dangerous situation. I mean, humor has to be a part of it, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, my unit was different. A lot of drugs, I hate to admit, but we did a lot of drugs, even in the bush. So we, you know, it was right at the time when the movie The Good, Bad, and the Ugly came out.
Yes.
And we thought we were the good, the bad, and the ugly, you know. And we used to say, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I'm the baddest son of a bitch in the valley, you know. And that's how we thought at 18, 19. You don't go into combat and think, uh-oh, I could get killed. No, you don't think like that.
And that's kind of why I talked about the, you know, invulnerability, because, I mean, there is a real reason why... there's more reasons than one why they don't take old people like us into the service. But, I mean, at 17, 18, 19, your brain hasn't even developed fully. So, you know, maybe your first exposure to death has been, you know, seeing grandma or grandpa or something like that.
Yeah.
What was that when you saw that, you know, face-to-face for the first time? When you know...
I didn't, you know, I actually hate to say this, but it's true. It never bothered me. It didn't bother me when other guys got killed in our unit. We lost 25 guys one morning in a half hour. It just didn't faze me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I went as a volunteer. So, you know, if you can't take the smoke, get out of the kitchen, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, to me, it was just, I mean, I unloaded dead GIs off choppers and I just didn't think about it, or else I did. And I, you know, I put it so far back in my subconscious.
Yeah.
And that's what post-traumatic stress is, you know?
Yeah. And I have a really good friend. I would call him kind of a sensitive guy, but he was a tough guy and a tough football player in high school. And his job was to, and you mentioned Yatrang, you know, the battle there. I know he went into that afterwards, and his job was to pick up, you know, body bags mm-hmm. and to do the, you know, make sure that everybody was dead, got back. And, he did that for, I don't know how many, you know, how many months, and just he came back to this country, and he had put it so far back in his mind that once he had time to think about it, that's kind of all she wrote. I mean, he's still alive, and but he's just a shell of, and it is the PTSD, and that's what, you know, he's receiving.
Yeah, well, a Marine friend of mine got me in the PTSD program after I'd been back almost 20 years, and he had himself had spent 4 years in Nam. He flew for the CIA in '65 in shorts and tennis shoes. He flew into Khe Sanh until you couldn't fly in anymore, so he was well versed in combat. And when he met me, I didn't even know this guy, but when he met me, I was taking his money from in this restaurant, and he was paying for his meal, and he saw my tattoo. I have a paratrooper tattoo, and he said, I want to talk to you. And I said, what about? And he goes, Nam. He just knew, you know, you can just look at somebody, and you know. And I said, Nam didn't bother me, I'm cool, you know, what's the problem, you know? And he said, no, you should meet me tomorrow for lunch. And I said, look, man, Nam didn't affect me. I'm cool. It's all right. And he said, I can't tell you exactly what he said, but he said, listen, mofo, you want to end up in prison? You're going to end up either dead or in prison, you know. And he said some other things about prison. And he was very straightforward. And
probably weren't very positive things about prison.
No.
Okay.
And so I met with him, and then he got me into the program, which was my lifesaver for me.
When you came back to this country, how were you treated? I mean, I hear really almost the exact opposite. I mean, I hear people that are really were really soldiers that were really welcomed into their communities and treated very well. And then, of course, you also hear the other side of it, you know, that a friend of mine, Steve, was told not to wear his uniform, you know, if he was out in public, that kind of thing. What was your experience?
I never had anybody, and I came here back in Seattle. We landed in Seattle, and we took off from Seattle. And then I went to San Francisco, visited relatives down there. I never had anybody say anything to me negative. You know, of course, I was the type of person when I came back that you wouldn't want to say anything like that to. You could look at me and know that you didn't want to say something wrong.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you when you got back here, you worked and you
No, I didn't work, you know.
Yeah. You were in, where were you, in Montana? Is that where you were?
No, I came back in Ohio. Okay. I mean, I was from Ohio.
Okay.
But I stayed out in California for a while. I mean, I can't tell you everything, obviously.
Right.
But I just didn't have to work at that time. Plus, I had my blood money, you know, that I saved.
Right.
You know, because I only drew, I was an E4, and we were getting $400 a month, and that's including jump pay and combat pay. And I sent 300 of it home, so I had a nice little nest egg when I got back, too.
Okay, so you had money to live on when you got back. Yeah, yeah, that's good. And what were the things that, when you were in Vietnam, that seemed to, well, probably other than animals that would jump out at you, but I've heard of one story of a Bengal tiger jumping over a guy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we ran up on a tiger. Uh-huh. I was with a recon team for part of my tour, too, a five-man team, and we ran up on a tiger in this elephant grass. We couldn't see him, but he stopped us dead in our tracks, and if you want to hear something to freeze the blood in your veins, is a tiger growl.
Uh-huh.
It stopped my whole team, and we were pretty savvy. We just froze, and we all grabbed grenades because we didn't want to shoot, because we didn't want to give our position away as far as that goes when anybody see muscle flashes, you know. So we all grabbed grenades, and I'm sure the Bengal tiger or whatever kind of tiger it was sensed the animosity in us, you know, because we were going to kill it, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And then all of a sudden he just disappeared. But
it's fascinating that even large animals like that are 10 times more powerful than you ever thought of being, you know, still are generally afraid of human beings just because of something they're not accustomed to.
Yeah.
How about other kinds of things? A lot of people talk about bugs and malaria. Did you mention that you had malaria?
I had malaria twice.
Uh-huh.
But the spiders and the snakes and, I mean, they had elephants. We ran into some orangutans.
Uh-huh.
You can believe it. Orangutans. Swinging through the jungle trees. And we just couldn't believe it. We were awestruck. You know, to see this this family of orangutans swinging through the trees like Tarzan, you know.
Yeah.
But they had bears and they had, you know, everything you can imagine.
Yeah, I know there is some type of a bear that's that is very common in that area. So.
They have wild boar, you know, lots of wild boar, which I learned the hard way, always to keep my weapon next to me.
because
wild boars ran down the trail one day when I was setting out some booby traps, and I left my my 16 up in this little bunker area and was, you know, stringing my wire down the hill, and I heard gunshots, and you know, my rifle was way up the top of the hill, so I, you know, scrambled up to the top, jumped over to the bunker, grabbed my weapon, and spun around, and it was wild hogs running down the trail. And they had shot them. A couple of guys had shot them. So, and one of them was a female, and she was dropping out piglets as she was running down, you know.
Oh.
And then one of the guys went over to the dead pig and took his knife out and cut the ham off, cut the leg, you know, strapped it to his ruck and walked down the trail. Ate it later on that day.
Wow. Well,
he was a wild man.
If, you know, being a LERP, like LERP, you were out there, for, like you said, for a couple weeks at a time sometimes. Were you, and you said you were resupplied about every 3 to 5 days. Was that pretty steady, or was that?
Yeah. Yeah.
So they knew exactly where you were. And yeah. What were your thoughts when you got ready? When you were, you did one full tour, right? 13 months?
No, I did 10. Because I had malaria towards the end.
Okay.
So I spent a month and a half in the hospital.
And where was that? In Japan?
No. I was in Quinyan and Nha Trang, two hospitals.
Okay.
On the coast.
Because I know one of the people we interviewed went to, they were in Japan.
Yeah.
In Japan for almost, and there must be different types of malaria too. I mean, some people get it a lot, get more serious. Is that fair enough to say?
Yeah, there's two, there's valsipral malaria and there's vivax. And I had both. And I think it's valsipral is incurable. Well, I still have it, you know.
Uh-huh.
It's not as bad now as it was 20 years ago.
Right.
But, yeah, there's different kinds of malaria.
Uh-huh.
And I had both, you know.
Were you, how often did you come in contact with the enemy? Pretty much all the time?
No. In fact, I never had anybody directly around me killed, wounded, but nobody close to me was ever killed. I did assist other units with their dead, but nobody close to me. Wounded, yes, but not mm-hmm. killed. Mm-hmm. So we, as a recon, you don't want to make contact. You just want to gather intel, you know. So
right.
We call airstrikes in on NVA base camps that we were able to locate, and we were kind of the eyes and the ears of our company.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So your purpose really was to figure out where they were and then send the airstrikes in and that kind of
thing. And, you know, just do recon, you know. Mm-hmm. Just now, we did make contact, but we did pull ambushes, and we went into a village one night, my team that had suspected VC. It was unfortunate. Our orders were to kill anybody that came out of the doors, you know, out of their hooch, which fortunately no one did that night. But we were, that's what we did, you know.
Yeah, you did what you were told.
My neighbor asked me one time, what did you do in Vietnam? And I said, well, I told him about this incident. If we had orders to kill you when you walked outside your door, that's what we would do. No questions asked.
Yeah, yeah. What would you say if you wanted someone to, what was the main thing you learned from being there, from being in Vietnam? Did you?
How to survive, you know, not to quit, you know, ever quit. Don't ever lay down, you know. The monsoon season in Vietnam, it rained 20 hours a day. And you're humping through, you know, mud and leeches and rain, and you're soaking wet and cold, and you just, you know, we had a saying, our mantra was don't mean nothing. Mm-hmm. That's what we used to say, it don't mean nothing.
Yeah.
And that's how we made it, you know. So psychologically I learned a lot, but you know, you learn a lot otherwise that gets you in trouble.
Yeah And so I think, you know, that's just about the end of our interview. Maybe we can have you back again. It sounds like we've got about one-tenth of your story here. So, and so far we haven't got anything incriminating on you, so that's good too. So,
yeah.
But it is, I really want to thank you, Robert. This is Robert DeGrappa. He is a Vietnam veteran, and he agreed to come in to be interviewed. So thank you very much, Robert.
You bet.
Appreciate your time.
You bet.
But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could.
April 30th, 1975 was the official end of the war in Vietnam. But to say it was the end of the war would not be giving all those who participated their earned respect. The collateral damage continues and causes suffering to this day. Dr. Steve Nurse, signing off.